starting by establishing a poorly defined diaspora with new horizons, a chapter filled with human anxiety and Jewish hope, inspiring moral commitment and occasional moral disappointment. And that is what we are going to explore tonight, that extraordinary chapter in our history. Now, look, what happened? 23 Jews came to what is now New York. And look what they have accomplished in 350 years. What is 300? What are 350 years in the history of the Jewish people? A history of 3,500 years. 200, 350, it's nothing. It's a blink of an eye. And yet, they who came from Recife in Brazil, and they came not because they wanted to, because they were expelled, because there the Inquisition was there already, and they had to suffer, and they left Recife. And you know, they came, by, of course, on a boat, and you know, everything that happened to them, we shall see later on, the marvelous story that they developed, how they arrived, and they were caught by pirates. The pirates needed money. Then a friendship, Saint Catherine, freed them, brought them to New Amsterdam. Peter Stuyvesant didn't want to keep them. In fact, he wanted them to be deported as soon as possible. He was anti-Semitically inclined. But he was overruled by a powerful Dutch company in Amsterdam. But it all began with a simple story, a fairy tale of an extraordinary man passionately involved with maps and oceans, drawn to faraway lands, unknown to him and to his contemporaries. Correction, it all began on September 7, 1654, with a dramatic story about a mistaken destination willed by destiny, a secret dream perhaps rooted in melancholy events in the history of an ancient people, too long dispersed and too often oppressed, eternally longing for a homeland. Was it nothing but an overwhelming desire of that adventurer and sea-intoxicated traveler to find a refuge for future multitudes of uprooted men and women, unwanted by nations and persecuted by religious communities in most areas of the planet? Need I name the hero of our story? Christopher Columbus. Who hasn't heard of his exploits? Who hasn't admired both his audacity and imaginative powers? If we are here on this soil, in this blessed country, it is thanks to his vision of worlds waiting to be visited and his decision to go and return with exalting discoveries. Was he simply a professional sailor and explorer? He was more than that. Was he just a loyal servant of the devout King Ferdinand and Queen Isabel of Spain who risked his life for the honor and glory of his country? Is that the only reason for his leaving behind his family and friends so as to lead his expedition to the uncharted territories of his exalted fantasy? Who was he? Innumerable stories and legends circulate about him. What is clear is that had he not discovered America, Jews would not have gone to Brazil and from there, 350 years ago, to New Amsterdam. And we would not have celebrated tonight their arrival. Naturally, we shall discuss its far-reaching impact on our lives now and on Jewish history in general, and perhaps on general history. But for the moment, let's stop at just one episode, or more precisely, on one aspect of his departure. The date, according to the Jewish calendar, remains beyond dispute. It happened on the ninth day of Av, 1492, when Spanish Jews were ordered by the church-dominated royal court to convert to Christianity or go into exile. When the last of them left the country, they crossed Columbus on his way to board Santa Maria, one of his ships that took him and his crew on his daring voyage. Destination yet unknown. Was it simply a coincidence? In Jewish history, there are no coincidences, only encounters. And they became almost preordained. If at the moment they seem deprived of meaning, they receive meaning later. And what is it? Remember, Columbus' aim was to reach not America, but India. Why? According to one theory, he, the son of Maranos, had heard of a Jewish state created by the lost 10 tribes that existed and flourished somewhere in India. So he wanted to go there and restore a link between them and their brethren still enduring exile. I like that theory. In fact, it was Columbus himself who admitted that the goal of his project had some Jewish connection. He wrote to King Ferdinand and Queen Isabel of Spain, and I quote him, "Having expelled the Jews from your dominions, your highnesses ordered me to proceed with sufficient armament to the region of India. But it is not to them, but to another Marano, Luis de Santangel, that he first communicated the result of his historic endeavor, which was privately financed by descendants of Jewish converts to Christianity." Strange as it may sound, Columbus' intuition about a Jewish kingdom in India, rooted in bits of information, was far from being erroneous. There was a kind of Jewish kingdom in Cochin. For 1,000 years, it lasted 1,000 years, and most of its remnants, when I was in India, I learned, made Aliyah in the 50s. Let me at this moment maybe open a very short parenthesis. When we speak of Israel, of course, not only historically, but as a land who occupies all our sensitivities and solicits all our passion, remember that Yitzhak Rabin, who was assassinated 9 years ago, there is a memory which is being celebrated or held, a commemoration held on Wednesday evening. Kehilat Yisrael on Wednesday evening. Close bracket. But Columbus disembarked, not in India, he disembarked in America. And thanks to him, exiled Jews from Spain and Portugal did find a haven in Brazil, which was then occupied by Portugal. And the first Jew to arrive in Boston was in 1649. We know his name, Salomon Franco. He didn't stay long. He was chased away from Boston. The first Jews to land as a group upon American soil was in New Amsterdam, as I said, September 1654, 23 adults and children. Well, thus began a new chapter in Jewish history. Both similar to and different from others, fascinating on more than one level, it contains major elements of what scholars call the mystery of Jewish survival. And may I now open parentheses. I want to thank, of course, Professor Steve Katz for his introduction and for the fact that he wanted me to speak about all the things that he didn't speak about. But mainly for leading the Center of Jewish Studies, which is blossoming and flourishing, attracting great talents and good students. And of course, thank you, President Chubayan, for being for the first time at one of my lectures. I knew about you. I never thought you would listen so well, but I think you are listening well to everybody, thanks to your medical background. Thank you, President Emeritus Silber, the friend who is always here. I want to thank the Consul General of Israel, who is here representing Israel. We always need to remember that when we speak on Jewish subjects, Israel is there, not only as a team, but as a presence. What Professor Katz actually wanted to speak, all of us to speak about America different. Of course, America is different, which I'll see later on, but there's a marvelous story about that. The story is that Stalin and FDR and Roosevelt at Yalta, they were discussing which land is better, where is there more freedom. And Roosevelt said to Stalin, Uncle Joe, he called him Uncle Joe, he said, Joe, in my land, I want you to know anyone can come to Washington in front of the White House and shout down with Roosevelt. And Stalin said, big deal. I can tell you anyone can come to the Red Square also and shout down with Roosevelt. But our freedom, of course, is measured not by jokes. It is serious. For historians, the first arrival of Jewish refugees to America's shores is a fiesta. No allegory, no fantasy, no imagination, only facts and memories. Everything has been recorded, where they came from, for what reason they stopped here, the first marriage, the first child, the first rabbi, the first synagogue. We know so much about them that we could see ourselves as their contemporaries. And therefore, when we speak about them, we know what we are talking about. Obsessed with memory, the Jewish people have kept alive always episodes and events that marked the beginnings of many of its communities in diaspora. The story of the first is in Scripture. It began with Joseph, who found himself a refugee in Egypt, followed by his family. Others were to experience a similar fate with less success in Babylon, Rome, the Rhine provinces, Poland, Russia, Spain, France, Greece, and North Africa. We know the geopolitical and geo-religious conditions of their migratory destiny. We know by whom they had been deported and where and how they rebuilt communal life with memories alone. Like Jacob's children in Egypt, the few became many. They multiplied and prospered, enabling some of their great men and women to occupy high positions in the world of finance, culture, and politics, and medicine, until another enemy rose who wanted them totally assimilated or entirely absent so as to put an end to their singular religious or ethnic aspirations. He isolated them in ghettos, burned them as heretics, and or condemning them to further exile and misery. With emphasis on detail, Jewish chroniclers felt it important to note that in 1654, Solomon Peterson was the first Jew to marry a Christian in New Amsterdam, now New York. That Asher Levi was a ritual butcher, a shochet, quote, excused from killing hogs because of his religion. I cannot see he made make a bracha on such a slaughter. In 1655, three Jews bought the first burial place in the first Jewish cemetery. The Lopez family was the first to acquire social prominence in the early 70s. Its founder, Aaron Lopez, a former Marano, who escaped from Portugal to Newport and remarried according to the law of Moses and Israel. Dr. Ezra Stiles, later president of Yale, spoke of him as the most universally beloved of any man he ever knew. And he continued, his beneficence to his family and the Jewish nation and the entire world is almost without a parallel. Lopez made him meet a renowned Jewish scholar and Kabbalist, Rabbi Chaim Yitzchak Karigal. Stiles was so impressed with the rabbi that he placed his portrait in the Yale Gallery of Important Spiritual Figures. We learn how the community grew larger and larger. In colonial times, it numbered around 1,000 to 1,500 members. Right away, its internal problems manifested themselves. How to observe kashrut, how to arrange communal services on the Sabbath and holidays, how to behave towards renegades, former apostates, how to attract rabbis and teachers and cantors. The first 52-page Sephardi prayer book for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur was printed in 1751. The rift between Ashkenazim and Sephardim couldn't be ignored. Complaints of discrimination mutually leveled on both sides are known. Which tradition should be followed? Mind you, that is not new. We always had it. We had it even in my town, in my little town. There were always quarrels for the piyutim, what to include in the liturgy. And they would fight. Finally, they went to authority and they asked, what should we do? And they said, follow your tradition. And they said, this is our tradition, to fight. But there the question was, which should be followed? In 1718, Yiddish or German-speaking Ashkenazim became the majority, but the services were conducted according to the Sfardi ritual. In New York's Sheirit Israel, it remains Sfardi to this day. In 1730, the first official synagogue as such was opened in New York thanks to a fundraising campaign among wealthy Jews in London, Curacao, and Barbados and other states. Fundraising is not a new phenomenon, not even today. In 1758, a beautiful synagogue was erected in Newport, Rhode Island, and it still functions as a historical landmark. Very fast for those times, 100 years or so later, Jews became a factor in public affairs. Jewish life in America reminds some researchers of the highest point of symbiosis that was attained during the Golden Age in Spain and the Weimar Republic in Germany. Who hasn't learned that both ended in tragedy? And who hasn't had the conviction that in this respect, the story of Jews in America has been and will remain different from the two others? Almost from the outset, numerous emigrants found this country special. Named only in 1912, the New World, it became what some called the Land of Promise, and others in Yiddish, the Golden Medina, the Land of Gold, and also in literature, Galut Shel Chesed, an exile of grace and compassion. But politically and psychologically, the community resembled others in quasi-similar situations. It took sides. To solve the so-called Jewish question, some chose to let their Jewishness vanish, while others believed in deepening it. Some prestigious families totally disappeared from Jewish history books. Others remained as inspiring mentors and benefactors in our chronicles. During the revolution, as always, Jews could be found within both camps. Some were for, others were against. The same was through the Civil War. Chaim Salomon helped the revolutionary cause. Others in New York and Newport remained loyal to the mother country. The same conflict prevailed during the Civil War. In the North, Jews opposed slavery with all their heart. And so, the humanism rooted in biblical law favoring the stranger. We have it in the Mishpatim. The first law, literally, after the Ten Commandments, is about slavery. That slavery is forbidden. It's not only forbidden to own slaves, it's forbidden to be a slave. And we are told the slave who chooses to remain a slave has to be punished because I am free and I choose my freedom, but I cannot choose not to be free. A slave who wants to remain a slave, therefore, is to be punished. And therefore, of course, we oppose slaves. However, we must also say that there were in the South Jews who were, small minority, yes, but there were, slave owners and slave merchants. In the halls of Congress, the voice of Judah Benjamin was heard supporting the legality of slavery. There were rabbis who preached the virtues of abolition, but others whose sermons praised the institution of slavery. However, the real debate took place around the problem of excessive integration bordering with assimilation. With the growth of the Jewish population, 2 million at the beginning of the 20th century, and its achievements in various fields of finance and culture, social success turned into a threat. What if the price for the sense of security would be too high? For it would be at the expense of Jewish identity. And what if the Jewish tradition would be the first victim of freedom accorded to Jews? Remember, emancipation caused similar problems in Eastern Europe later on. In Eastern Europe, where Jews benefited from their newly acquired rights, they used those rights not to build more yeshivot, but to enroll in colleges. In 1839, Lazarus Cohen, a teacher of Unzleben in Germany, entrusted Jewish emigrants from his city going to America with the following message, quote, "Friends, you are traveling to a land of freedom where the opportunity will be presented to live without compulsory Jewish education. Resist and withstand this tempting freedom, and do not turn away from the religion of our fathers. Do not throw away your sacred faith for quickly lost earthly pleasures, for your faith brings you consolation and quiet in this life and will bring you certain happiness in other life. Do not tear yourself away from the laws in which your fathers and mothers searched for assurance and found it. The promise to remain good Jews must never and should never be broken during this trip, not in your life at home, nor when you go to sleep, nor when you rise again, nor in the education of your children." End of quote. The fears included in this letter were well-founded. In the colonial period, 10 to 15% of American Jews intermarried. Granted, hundreds of synagogues were opened in the coming decades. Everywhere people quoted George Washington's superb letter to the Newport Synagogue in which he pledged, "His government will give to bigotry no sanction and to persecution no assistance." Later, when General Ulysses Grant ordered all Jews expelled from the army. His order was revoked by Lincoln. But with the years passing, religion lost ground among the young. The conflicts of generations erupted mainly in the first part of the 20th century, when children of East European immigrants chose to rebel against their parents' ties to their religious past and opted for anarchist theories, nihilism, socialism, secular Zionism, communism, and atheism. Those were the years when the then anti-religious Daily Forward, changed later on, but I worked for it, published articles and ads appealing to its readers, to Jewish readers, to abandon Yom Kippur services and replace them with festive dinners and balls. Those were the years when a warning by a Lithuanian sage did not sound out of place. And he wrote, I quote him, "In America," he said, "kosher food is not to be found anywhere. In America, even the stones are treif or impure for consumption." Little did he know that one day we will have hundreds of kosher restaurants in New York and in Boston and everywhere. In other words, in some ultra-religious circles, people believe that to emigrate to America meant to stop being Jewish. Almost a century ago, in 1907, Israel Friedlander, professor of Bible at the Jewish Theological Seminary, delivered an address whose pessimism reflected such fears. The lecture was called "The Problem of Judaism in America," and insisted on the possibility that the benefits of freedom for Jews could bring about their de-Judaization. He was mainly concerned with the absence of great minds in this community. He said, I quote him, "In times gone by, Italy presented one of the finest and brightest faces of Jewish culture. Only two generations ago, it was still able to produce a personality so profoundly, so genuinely Jewish as Shmuel David Luzzatto, and to present American Jewry in our own generation with a man like Sabato Morais. Now the condition of Judaism in Italy is one of utter stagnation." In France, he continued, where centuries ago Talmudic Judaism found its most brilliant exponents, "Judaism is but a lifeless and an unsuccessful imitation of French Catholicism." In Germany, he said, "we stumble on all sides against indifference and apostasy." And what about America? His diagnosis is sad. The condition here, he declared, is scarcely different. He admits that there was a tremendous growth of American Judaism with its ever-increasing number of congregations and institutions. But these, he said, did not represent an organic growth from within, but the result of great minds that came from the ghettos. In general terms, he believed that American Jews were blind to the fact that the dawn of the Jews is the dusk of Judaism, that the nearer the problem of Jewry reaches its solution, the more complicated and the more dangerous becomes the problem of Judaism, that the more emancipated, prosperous, and successful the Jews become, the more impoverished, defenseless, and threatened becomes Judaism, the only reason and the only foundation of their existence. End of quote. Was he right? Certain facts may prove his point. Little or nothing remained from one time Alexandria's great schools of Talmud. Has Christianity survived because it adjusted to modernity, whereas Judaism survived because it didn't? But what about the times and places where Jews did adjust? Among the first to convert in medieval Catholic Spain were small communities, and their spiritual leaders, rabbis, led their communities to conversion. And what place do they occupy in Jewish history? Which of Moses Mendelssohn's, the great philosopher, the author of the Biur, which of his descendants remain Jewish? Can Jewish culture be severed from Jewish tradition? Like Shimon Dubnov, the greatest of the Jewish historians and my favorite, Friedlander believed in the spiritual and cultural power of the Jewish people and not in its political influence. In spite of his pessimism, he predicted that America will become world Jewry's most vibrant center. And together with Achat Ha'am, Friedlander and Dubnov were cultural Zionists. Both died tragically. Friedlander was murdered in 1920 while on a humanitarian mission in the Ukraine. Dubnov perished in 1941 in the Riga ghetto, murdered by a Gestapo officer who was his former student in Germany. Of this, maybe we shall talk another time, because he deserves a full lecture. This great historian who ended his life in the ghetto. And we know from chroniclers, from witnesses, that he kept on writing his last volume of Jewish history, the greatest, really the greatest, better than Gretz. And his writings vanished. And I'm convinced, like the Ringelblum diaries, that they were buried somewhere where he lived, in the ghetto. And one day my dream is to take a group of students, perhaps, and go to Riga and start digging. Could secular culture of Jews save them from enemies determined to lead to destruction? The answer is clear, it did not. Could Jewish culture save them? Could Jewish culture be saved? Will it be? By whom? In the introduction to his remarkable study of American Judaism on its 350th anniversary of the arrival of Jews to America, the young historian, the brilliant Jonathan Sarna, the son of the great scholar Nachum Sarnazal, tells of his own experience as he first became interested in the American Jewish life and its history. I quote him, "I mentioned my interest," he said, "to a scholar at a distinguished rabbinical seminary, and he was absolutely appalled. 'American Jewish history,' he growled. 'I'll tell you all that you need to know about American Jewish history. The Jews came to America, they abandoned their faith, they began to live like Gentiles, and after a generation or two, they intermarried and disappeared. That,' he said, 'is American Jewish history. All the rest is commentary. Don't waste your time. Go and study Talmud.'" Obviously, the distinguished scholar was unaware of the extraordinary growth of Talmudic schools that already seemed to flourish in post-war America. Some observers speak of a true Jewish renaissance in the field of learning and culture, in literature and music, science and art, politics and academia. Jews have had an impact on the general environment, which is disproportionate to the demographic situation which is ours. Others go as far as maintaining that since antiquity, there were never, not even in ancient Palestine and Babylon or Alexandria, as many Jewish schools with their teachers and students as there are now in the United States alone. Until the 1950s, Jews encountered grave and often scandalous obstacles to be admitted to the best universities in the country. Professors, chairholders in Jewish studies were rare. Today, few academic institutions do not offer courses and programs in Jewish history, literature, and religion. Everywhere, classes on Holocaust-related subjects are overcrowded and registered. Israel, Yiddish literature, and medieval poetry have never attracted as many students. In the larger context, even before World War II, American Jews did not fail their people. A strange visionary, Mordechai Noach, writer and diplomat, gathered a rally in 1824 in Buffalo and proclaimed the establishment of an Ir Miklat, a city of refuge named Ararat for homeless Jewish refugees. It didn't take off. His three sisters converted to Christianity. But as an idea, it sounded exciting. When the Damascus blood libel inflicted fear and suffering on the Jewish community in Syria and its neighbors, they succeeded here in America to mobilize all the efforts of the Jews to prevail upon Washington to come to the defense of the Syrian Jews. The same may be said about the reaction to the Baylis affair in Kiev, when in the 30s Arab staged murderous pogroms in Palestine, 25,000 Jews filled Madison Square Garden, offering their solidarity with their victimized brethren. The Balfour Declaration, promising a homeland for the Jewish people, galvanized American Jewry. To be Jewish was no longer an obstacle to success. Literature and music welcomed Jews with honors. Felix Frankfurter was a respected member of the Supreme Court. Bernard Baruch on Wall Street, Henry Mergenthal on presidential cabinets. Pluralism was not an empty word, nor was equality. Was there no discrimination? There was. Shameful racial discrimination towards black people, religious and ethnic disrespect for minorities, excluding them from clubs, hotels, and apartment buildings. But compared to my generation, what it had to endure in Europe, America was a paradise. When I arrived in the United States in 1956, I was surprised to find a vibrant Jewish atmosphere. Religious in Brooklyn, cultural in Manhattan, I thought I understood why George Washington called America the promised land for the Jews. 4 Yiddish daily newspapers, several Yiddish weeklies, monthly magazines, a number of Yiddish theaters proved the vitality of a culture that was near extinction in the old continent. Yiddish humor invaded Hollywood and the Borscht Belt and Broadway. Yiddish poets were admired. Writers applauded. It's, after all, it's bellow here, Saul Bellow and Philip Roth and Malamud. Wherever you turn, you find Jewish names on the, at the summit of literary creativity. The Forward, where I worked together with I.B. Singer, was the largest daily, and the Communist Freiheit the smallest. The Forward was more Jewish than socialist, and the Freiheit more communist than Jewish. When the bloody Arab hate pogroms erupted in Palestine, the Freiheit, the Communist Freiheit, condemned first the Arab hooligans and their British supporters. Shortly afterwards, ordered by Stalin, it changed its attitude both in tone and content, and now its headline banner accused the Zionist fascists who have provoked the Arab uprising. It took many events, many years for the Jewish communist writers to show their disappointment in Stalin's anti-Semitism and to accept the idea that Jewish solidarity is an essential trait of Jewish identity and Jewish survival. A Jew alone must not be left alone. When Jews were expelled from Spain and Portugal, they were received with open arms by their co-religionists in Greece and Morocco. When Jews were targeted in the smallest village in Europe, their fear was felt by Jews in Chicago and Boston. Has it always been so in our land of freedom, in our land of freedom of social justice, which meant to be the world capital of human compassion? And the question, of course, is it still so today? My question is, would the Father Coughlin's vicious anti-Semitism, would it be popular today as it was in the 30s? Would Charles Lindbergh, the all-American hero, have dared to be so openly anti-Semitic now as he was then? Remember, in spite of his pro-Hitler views and anti-Semitic statements, Charles Lindbergh was sent by President Truman on a mission to post-war occupied Germany. Lindbergh was made general by President Eisenhower. Lindbergh was invited to the White House more than once by President Nixon. We forgot who that man was, that he was decorated by Hitler, by Himmler, by Goering, and he openly was pro-Nazi. During the last 60-odd years, American Jewry feels that this could never happen now. We feel that Jewish life must center its activity defining identity around two major themes: the Holocaust, the darkest moment in Jewish history, and Israel, the most luminous. In other words, a Jew felt himself or herself Jewish by linking their faith to the memory of the dead in Europe and to the hope of the living in Israel. Let's admit it. In general terms, many Jews in the ghettos, rightly or not, had a painful feeling that American Jews, especially on leadership levels, had let them down. It began with a sad story of St. Louis. More than 1,000 Jewish refugees were aboard the ship. They had visas to Cuba, but were not allowed to disembark. So the ship was sent back to Germany. The captain, a good person, a Gentile captain of the ship, a German, knew what the refugees knew, what was waiting for them in Germany. After all, the event occurred several months after the Kristallnacht, and he therefore encouraged them to do everything they could to disembark in America. The ship spent days and nights not far from American shores, but Roosevelt refused, and to this day I don't understand why. He was supposed to be a father figure to American Jewry and to me. Believe me, in my little town, I did not know the name of Ben-Gurion, hardly heard of Herzl. I was in a yeshiva world. But I knew the name of Franklin Delano Roosevelt as the friend of the Jewish people. We made prayers, we said prayers for him. And he refused 1,000 men and women and children, sending them back to Germany. Have the Jews in America tried? Have they done enough to make Roosevelt change his attitude? I don't know. Have they tried hard enough? I don't know. There are so many things I don't know. More worry about what came later. I, at times, am moved to despair. It is because of what came later. And I say this with anguish and sorrow. Need I repeat what I must have stated more than once, namely that I do not consider myself a judge, but only a witness. I try to refrain myself from passing judgment on others. I do not believe that Jewish leaders in the early 40s were insensitive to Jewish suffering and indifferent to what was happening over there under the silent heavens of Auschwitz and Majdanek. Did they know? And if they did, could they have done more to move the Allies to save more Jews from unspeakable horrors and death? Historians disagree on the answers, but I read and reread letters written in the ghettos, and what I find in them is heartbreaking. I read and reread the commander-in-chief of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, Mordechai Anielewicz's pathetic appeals to Jewish leaders in London and America, urging them to declare mass demonstrations and hunger strikes, all political and tactical explanations why so little was done lose their human weight. The fact is that nothing was even tried. I have asked 5 American presidents and countless senators and representatives and generals why the Allies did not bomb Birkenau, why they did not bomb the railways leading to Birkenau, and they had no answer. But in truth, the same question could also have been addressed with equal poignancy to Jewish leaders of the time. I have been tormented by these unanswerable questions for many years, but particularly this year, which marks, so to speak, the 60th anniversary of the extermination of Hungarian Jewry, which I will repeat it with my last breath, could have been saved. In fact, of all the large Jewish communities in German-occupied Europe, it alone could have been saved, and it wasn't. It could have been saved because it was the last, because it began days before D-Day and lasted for weeks after D-Day. Hitler had lost the war already. The whole world knew it. The German nation knew it. The end was near. Allied aircrafts dominated the skies. There was little to stop them from bombing weapons, factories, and railways. At that time, 10,000 Jews, men, women, and children were gassed and burned daily in Birkenau alone. Had the railways been destroyed, it would at least have slowed down the process and told Berlin that somebody cared. Why weren't they? Again, I do not accuse, indict, or condemn anyone, but my questions remain questions. That also applies on a quite different level to what I used to feel about official Jewish passivity towards Russian Jewry in the early years of our battle for their freedom. I visited the Soviet Union in 1965 and brought back a personal report on its Jews. I described their fear, but also their courageous struggle for hope. I told the tale of young Jews who in the thousands gathered on Simchat Torah in front of the great synagogue of Archipova, expressing their allegiance with fervor and song to the Jewish people and its destiny. I called my book The Jews of Silence, but it was misunderstood and surely misinterpreted. I did not say that they, the Russian Jews, were the Jews of Silence, but that we were the Jews of Silence. I mainly directed my criticism at our leadership, as always. It was impossible to move its members to action. I remember my late friend Abraham Joshua Heschel and I would go from conference to conference, from convention to convention, trying to make people aware of what was happening in the Soviet Union, without success. Most leaders had other priorities and many excuses for not doing anything. Who came to our demonstrations? Teenagers. Thank God for them. At best, their parents brought them by car at our gathering and left. In truth, the situation changed, and when it changed, it was thanks to the children. At one point, they prevailed upon their parents, saying, "Your generation did not do enough for European Jews when they needed you. Let's not repeat their moral mistakes and their historical failures, because then we too shall be criticized." In the final analysis, the Renaissance of Russian Jewry will remain one of the most spectacular triumphs in the 20th century's Jewish history. Logically, Russian Jews could have vanished from the stage. They did not. In Israel, they now play central roles in politics, industry, the arts, and the sciences. 1 million Russian Jews live now in Israel. When I think of them, I feel so proud, so rewarded. Never would I have believed, when I was then in Russia, and I went a lot, never that I would see that miracle. And the truth is, it's thanks to Israel that they had the desire to live, the desire to be Jewish, and to continue a story, our story, to the end of times. And in conclusion, this brings us to the second element, Israel, motivating Jewish existence in America today. How is one to measure a community's commitment to its own passion for a land and a people on the other side of borders and oceans? How is one to explain that the majority of American Jews have not even visited Israel? How do they manage to resist, be it their curiosity, just to see what the Jewish state, the dream of their parents and grandparents, looks like? Just to feel what a Jew feels when he or she walks in the old Jewish quarter of Jerusalem, filled with prayers from the time of David and Jeremiah. Not so long ago, some leaders in Israel felt what Jews in the ghettos had felt, that they were let down by American Jews. It happened after the Suez campaign in 1956. It was a military triumph and a political defeat. There was no reason for Israel then to join the colonial powers for its, really, for its monetary gain. The Eisenhower administration applied inordinate pressure on Israel to give back the Sinai to Egypt. The Russians threatened the nuclear weapons. Ben-Gurion was convinced that American Jews would rally behind Israel, but they did not. His place to some of them went unheeded. Their response was polite but negative. Were they afraid of being accused of double loyalty? Whatever the reason, they must have felt humbled by the test. Their failure was also Ben-Gurion's defeat. It hurt him as much as the first. He then met with Baron Guy de Rothschild of France and presented him with a stunning proposal to dissolve the Zionist movement altogether. Who needs it, he said, since it proved to be disloyal and useless, and replace it simply with a worldwide network of associations of friends of Israel. It was an outburst of anger and bitterness on his part, and nothing came of it, thank God. What is the situation of Jews today in America? Is it still a different country? Say, things are different, of course. Things are different. Times have changed. American Jews are no longer afraid to speak up against the administration's policy in the Middle East, even when it's unfair to the Jewish state. What you mentioned, Dr. Katz, is true. I always thought about it. What I then spoke to President Reagan, with whom I had very warm relations, I would not have been able to do that in any other country, only in America, that the refugee Jews such as myself, who really became, let's say, American, who came to America stateless, loving, a lover of Israel, came here and worked first as a journalist. I didn't come as a refugee. I came as a journalist here first. And so an accident, I stayed. But nowhere could a man like me go to the White House and speak that way with utter frankness, without any fear, to the President of the United States. It's when I said, I belong to a tradition that compels me to speak truth to power. And the expression got caught on. Now there are books called Speaking Truth to Power, forgetting that, no, after all. Demographically, of course, there's a problem which we hear about. The birth rate being what it is, American Jews are getting smaller in number, but not necessarily weaker in influence. We have learned lessons from our forerunners that arrived to settle here 350 years ago, the most important one being that the Jews' principal obligation in society is to remain Jewish, even when it means to help others, other communities, other minorities, work for human rights, work for their happiness, for their welfare. The place of a Jew in history is measured by his or her place in Jewish history. That is what we must learn. Our priorities must be Jewish, but without at the same time ceasing to be universal. In other words, they are to be inclusive, not exclusive. I don't believe in triumphalism. I don't believe in this ghettoism. We are who we are, but because we are part of the human family, we must look around us. And if people suffer, we must help them. If people are being massacred in Africa, we must help them. In Sudan, we must help them. In Rwanda, we must help those who are still there. We must do it simply because we are not only Jews, we are human. We are part of humanity. And so, to help another person or another community of persons is an ethical commandment, but not if it means to give up my Jewishness in order to attain that. It is the Jew in me that is universal. To relinquish the one or the other is nothing but a mutilating, self-defeating exercise. And this concept has been tried in our other countries and societies, but never as fruitfully as here in America. Now, as 350 years ago, more young Jewish students are eager to learn where they come from and for what purpose. They discover the beauty and the magic and enrichment one finds in learning. How did the late Louis Finkelstein put it? Every people has its aristocracy. We Jews have ours. Our aristocrat is the scholar. The respect that we pay the scholars is unique. And so with all the challenges still before us and with all the occasional disappointments and setbacks we may encounter in attempting at affirming the creative ingredients of our Jewishness as a factor in history, I think of America and the Jew in America with less apprehension than hope. Here as elsewhere, anti-Semitism comes and goes and comes again. It disturbs and frightens me, but it puzzles me even more. It is the oldest group hatred from antiquity to have survived antiquity. When and by what means will it disappear? Whatever may we do to change people's image of us, it must and not and will not alter our image of ourselves. The fact is that if Auschwitz did not cure the world of anti-Semitism, what can and what will? I know, we all know, that much is still to be done to justify the hope of our ancestors. What they have invested in their future, which is our present, but the effort is worthwhile. What about tomorrow? How are we to anticipate America's Jewish revolution? Naturally, I'm not speaking about the next 350 years. I won't be here. I do not invite you to think or look that far ahead. Instead, I would suggest to explore a simple question which these days does contain a certain urgency. Where and at what pace is Jewish history in general, and in America in particular, going? How are we to measure its direction? Is it still going uphill? Will it be defined by the challenging embodiment of its promise or by its fears of unthinkable threats and perils which are not only addressed at us, but also targeted at the whole world? Will America replace Eastern Europe with its new forms of what used to be the kingdom of the shtetl? In other words, we are speaking not about tomorrow, but about the day after. I know the pessimists among us love to quote statistics. It seems that we are losing ground. Intermarriage, especially in small urban areas, slow yet unstoppable assimilation, general negligence in matters of education. Astonishingly few Jews, therefore, are really motivated to take on their destiny and continue to be leaders with moral concepts. When I came to America, we had here 6 million Jews. Have we lost 1 million? That's why I hear. Some insensitive theoreticians go as far as calling the process a new Holocaust, which I resent, implying that there will be a time when we shall become less than a minority. Well, I don't agree with such pessimistic outlook. We seem to distrust and dislike statistics. Admit it. Also, Jewish tradition negates both the necessity and the validity of statistics. We simply refuse to believe in numbers. If we were to rely on their logic, our people would have long vanished from the surface of history. We did not lack opportunities, at times seduced by conversion, often opposed or to oppressed in religious confrontations, seemingly abandoned by the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, vanquished by armies of gigantic empires, exiled to the far corners of the earth. In terms of pure logic, we could have more than once gone under. Wasn't that the message sent to us by history? Go away, people of Israel. We don't want your gifts nor your poison. Go, disappear. Slowly, very slowly, or dramatically, very dramatically, at your own pace or at ours, but go. And China's leader, Mao Zedong, heard from a visitor that the Jewish people number only 14 million. He is supposed to have exclaimed, "What? In my land," he said, "the figure is accepted as an accountant's mistake." "Only 3 million in Israel," he said, "give them a hotel." But we are still here in history, and how did they manage? My late teacher and friend, whom I remember every day when I opened the Talmud, Saul Lieberman Zal, once gave me the following explanation. And this is, of course, our conclusion. It happened during the weeks preceding the Six-Day War of 67. The worldwide Jewish community lived in anguish. Personally, as a correspondent at the United Nations, I was desperate. I listened to the Arab delegates and the then PLO leader, Ahmed Shukeri, Yasser Arafat's predecessor, speaking freely about their resolve to throw all the Israelis into the sea. I believe that it could very well happen. In France, the great philosopher Raymond Aron published the front-page editorial in Le Figaro saying, "I do not wish to survive Israel." Some of us, many of us, shared his feeling. I went then to Israel. I was single, had nobody. I went during the war thinking that I will be there when it happened. I confess, I sinned. I sinned because I didn't have the faith in the Israeli army, which I should have had. I really believe that the world has already prepared the eulogies. Well, the only one who was optimistic. It was Shaul Lieberman. And his optimism disturbed me. I asked him, how do you manage to look so cheerful? Aren't you worried? Listen to his answer. I almost quote him verbatim. He said, the master of the universe is like a banker. When the bank invests too much in an enterprise, it can no longer let it go bankrupt. God has for such a long time invested so much in the Jewish people that he can no longer withdraw from it. That's the reason for my faith, he said. Well, I know nothing about banking, but I know something about history. So therefore I say it's the reason for my faith too. My faith for America, for Israel, for America's Jews. Granted, we know that occasionally under outside or internal pressure there were communities that dissolved themselves, but not here. Most communities, old and new, are endowed with what the philosopher Henri Bergson calls the élan vital. Call it faith, awareness, commitment, memory, conscientiousness, a desire to stay above ground, alive and creative, like an open hand. Paul Celan, the great poet who died, committed suicide, he, in one of his poems, said, in poignée de main, a handshake is a poem. And we can be that handshake. And so I believe that wherever we are, we look at others, friends and allies, contemporaries, and we share their destiny as they share ours. And we are all possessed by an irresistible urge to invoke hope, even when it seems frail, even when at times there is none. And that is the story of Christopher Columbus is coming here. Thank you.
You've just heard the second of three lectures in the annual series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner, Elie Wiesel. Next week, we'll have the third and final lecture in this annual series, entitled Evil and Redemption. For a CD or a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Mike Toda, with help from Ian Hughes. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.